You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, christianhumanist.org.
History as a practice examines the contingent. Everything that leaves evidence of having happened might have happened otherwise, and nothing has come to be except that it displaced other things that might have been. In the realm of black religion in the United States, the what-if questions and counterfactuals wonder about a 70-year-old Dr. King, to be sure, but they also wonder about the directions that theological and political and cultural movements took and what possibilities lost to contingency might be worth reclaiming these decades after his death. Such claims and counterclaims are the stuff of Dr. Gary Dorian's book, A Darkly Radiant Vision, The Black Social Gospel in the Shadow of MLK, from Yale University Press. And Christian Humanist Profiles is thrilled to welcome Dr. Dorian back to the show. Gary, thank you for joining us again.
Nathan, I'm delighted and grateful to be back with you.
This book, A Darkly Radiant Vision, stands as the third book in a trilogy. Since we didn't talk together about the other two volumes on the show, take a moment to tell listeners about the other two that lead up to this third book.
Well, the first two volumes in this series are titled The New Abolition, W.B. Du Bois and the Black Social Gospel, and Breaking White Supremacy, Martin Luther King Jr. and the Black Social Gospel. I have a lot of books out there, but this project dealing with the Black Social Gospel is the one that has had a special place in my heart and mind for my entire career, just even the thought of it. For 20 years, I wrote many articles and sprinkled into numerous books an argument that I have long had about the Black Social Gospel, which is a tradition that has almost no literature, and frustrated me that there was virtually that this tradition of theology and activism is never treated as a tradition as such. So we have shelves and shelves and shelves of books on the social gospel that dominated the white church, white Protestant churches in places like where I teach at Union, and nothing remotely comparable to a very similar phenomenon that occurred in black churches and in denominations that were involved in the Federal Council of Churches, the very same ecumenical organization of all these white social gospelers. So for many years, I put this argument out there and pleaded for someone better than me to write this story. I knew it would require an elaborate frame. It's a couple hundred years of history. It's an enormous sort of project, and I certainly wasn't the person best suited for it. But then waited, and it didn't happen, and no one sort of took me up on it. Meanwhile, I had a dear friend here at Union Seminary, who's the founder of Black Liberation Theology, who just kept saying to me, "For God's sake, Gary, it's your obsession. Just write it. Just start writing it." And I almost waited too long. I was seriously ill when I finally started writing The New Abolition, and feared that I'd waited too long. So when I did get that book out, that was the highlight of my whole academic career, just to have hung in there long enough, finally, to have written what was volume one. And that was the basic argument about what the Black Social Gospel was in the 19th and early 20th centuries. And I argued that it had four ideological traditions. It isn't just one thing, but that there was so much more of it than what historians claim. It took me 600 pages just to talk about these four different streams and the huge number of people involved in it and the debates. And yes, the Du Bois versus Washington argument that's right there at the center of it, including all those church people surrounding both of those figures. So that's The New Abolition. And so by the time I've finished that book, I've now made an argument that there is a Black social gospel tradition that takes you to Martin Luther King Jr., because he didn't come from nowhere. He had mentors who are the first and second generation leaders of this intellectual activist tradition. And so in the generation just before him, that's people like Mordecai Johnson, the president of Howard University, and Benjamin Mays, the president of Morehouse College, and Howard Thurman, the great Howard Thurman, a mystical theologian, and J. Pius Barber, King's pastor, when he went to Crozier Seminary. Those four especially were the mentors that he just tried to be like them in the early years of his own adulthood, and then found himself taken by the whirlwind of what became the movement when lightning struck in December 1955. And now we're into what we all call the civil rights movement, which is really just the iteration of a much longer civil rights movement. But this particular iteration of it, of course, was the one that ran from 1955 to 68. All of that is backstory to this third volume. All three of these books stand on their own because they're standing now in contexts where you're in a new moment, something wholly different and new is occurring. Now, in the first generation, it's the sheer necessity of creating a new abolition movement. Now that you've had to ask the terrible question of what a new abolition even would be, now that Reconstruction has come and gone, and we've got a mania of racist terrorism going on in this country, and people losing the 14th and 15th Amendments that were just passed the day before yesterday. And with King, of course, there is something so singular about that moment, 55 to 68, that civil rights generation and all that went on there. But that's a quite discrete thing itself. Once King was cut down, we're in a whole other moment of American political history and American religion and culture. And so this third volume is my telling of this same tradition from the early 1970s to the present day. And I'll just say one last thing. My friend Jim, whom I've already invoked here, when he was on me to write this thing, Jim always had lots of advice for me, but this time he was now, you know, don't let too many people into it. He'd say, you know, squeeze it hard. And I knew what he meant. It's not a tradition if I let too many people into it. It's if it's too porous, if it just defines every Black church person who was involved in some kind of activism, it's just too wide ranging to really give justice to what it is. On the other hand, it isn't just one thing. It isn't only that group surrounding Du Bois in the NAACP. And for one thing, if I do define it that way, which Jim was kind of pushing me this way, but if I had just gone from that sort of that group that's before and then during Du Bois and NAACP, left wing of NAACP, heading to Johnson and Barber and those people, heading to Martin Luther King, if I just do that, well, I'm going to have hardly any women in this story because women just aren't organizing the same way and just not. They're not including that middle volume story about the SCLC. Well, none of them were leaders of the SCLC. Ella Baker wanted to be, but she wasn't. Neither was Dorothy Gutten. That was a Black preachers movement. So I defined in volume one, I defined it narrowly and broadly. I'm always focused on, yes, there is a narrow thing, but then there's also a broader. There are broader circles here that are part of this story, that feed into it, that are part of it. And that's where, of course, you get a lot of women then into the story then in volume one. And then something similar now with volume three. Volume three is more like volume one than volume two, because in two, there's something so particular there. Southern Christian Leadership Conference and SNCC that just has to be chronicled, that civil rights generation. So I'm now back in volume three with a book that's isn't simply attending to specific idioms, although those are there. Again, there's a strong tradition of folks in volume three who just want to be like Martin and just want to fulfill Martin's dream. That's just how they talk about it. But there are plenty of folks in my, you know, in this new book who that's not, they're not like that at all. And yet they certainly belong in this story.
Right. And one of the figures who features early is someone I'm familiar with, having lived in Georgia for 20 years, and that's Andrew Young. And granting that the book raises and engages questions that a brief interview can only foreshadow, how does Andrew Young make his own case for his engagement with, I mean, honestly, the establishments in the political and the corporate and the industrial world? And, how does his career set the stage for the, what I see is the more radical critiques that emerge in other parts of the book.
Yes, well, Andy Young's father was a dentist in New Orleans, and his mother is a light-colored person from the Creole section of town, and he grew up middle class. And he said his whole life, if he had not come to terms, not only with being a product of a middle class, but of being thoroughly middle class himself, had he never not come to terms with that, he could not have done anything. For the movement, he had to come to terms with who he was before he could even find his place, or Martin Luther King could find a place for him in the organization. That's how that had to work. And so the first thing to say about Andy, especially since Nathan, you went for the sort of yes, Andy Young ends up being this kind of creature of corporate America, the big corporate wealth and so on. So how do you square, early Andy Young with later one? And there are a whole people say a lot of things about that. And so often he's accused of selling out and so on. I think that is not right. Andy Young was has there's a real continuity of perception and of character in his life throughout his life, and that point I just made is the crucial thing to it. He has never been anything but this very middle class figure who relates to different kinds of folks, readily crosses the color line back and forth, has no real argument per se with the bourgeoisie, except to say the only problem with the black bourgeoisie, not nearly big enough, not nearly thick enough, right? That's the issue. Is that we don't even really have a big capitalism form of the bourgeoisie. We just have, dentists and lawyers and people like that. That's what the bourgeoisie is in the black world. So we'd be just so much better off. And this story only gets better if there's an if indeed in African American culture there is a middle class that looks far more like that white middle class. That has wealth and property and, is able to pass on what they've earned to their children and so on. Andy Young has never been anybody but that person. He was that way in the civil rights movement, even when he was out there getting his head busted in St. Augustine and nearly getting, worried that he's going to get stabbed in Chicago and it'll all be worthless. Even during then, when by some lights, he's some kind of radical. He's certainly he's radical in certain ways that make him much like King. And yet, in his case, he's got very little to do with any kind of critique of corporate capitalism or the like. He just wants to get more black people into corporate capitalism. And of course, you give him enough years, he does do that because his career, lands four different places. But by the time he goes home, goes back to Atlanta and is mayor of Atlanta. Yeah, he was the rainmaker. And now is helping to make Atlanta a kind of corporate oasis that he really always aspired to. So it's not like, it's not like he became something else later on. I think I would even want to add this since so much of the commentary about him along that later line is bitter and mine is critical. I mean, I certainly drag you through all the
Oh yeah,
issues
to be sure, to be
in
sure.
that book. And yet it's not, I don't have that kind of, I don't need to sort of put him down or any such thing. I see the integrity that is in him. Moreover, he only really did any buck raking for himself after he lost the race to go statewide. He tried to keep running for office. He just kind of ran out of places he could run from, because Atlanta was his mochi. Once he tried to go statewide and he got humiliated, and now needs a job. Then he went that latter part of his life in his 70s when Yes, he made a lot of money for himself. But long before then, he made a ton of money for Atlanta, and indeed created that black middle class that he always said Atlanta would be better off for, and so would every other city.
Right. Now, Young, presents an interesting contrast to Jesse Jackson, who's another early figure in the book. And my own familiarity with him pretty much starts and ends with his runs for president. I was 11 years old in 1988, so that was the first I heard of him. Talk to our listeners a bit in broad strokes about his public projects. My sense is that if a public figure in 2024 both advocated against Joe Biden's mass incarceration legislation, which Jackson did, and also went to public schools telling young African American men to take their education more seriously, which he did, that the law and order right would tear him apart for one of those, and the academic critical theorists would tear him apart for the other. Was Jackson a contradictory figure in his own moment, or have times just changed that make him seem that way now?
Yeah. Firstly, Jesse is a singular figure. He's an American original. Just he contains multitudes, like what Whitman called, the American originals. So there he is. He's a seminarian in Chicago when King took the struggle north to Chicago. And of course, taking the struggle north means you're going in a place where the SCLC has no experience. They have nobody really in the movement that is not from the South. I mean, Diane Nash lived in the South, lived in Chicago, but by then she had two children and was not really that deeply involved in movement stuff on the ground. And that's the city that they went to. Chicago was a place with the powerful Democratic machine. That spreads patronage all around, and which you just don't even have this sort of collections of black churches who've got some kind of agency of their own within activism, or at least could be mobilized for activism if someone like Martin Luther King comes along. King has nothing like that going for him when he chooses Chicago to be the place where he goes north. And meanwhile, first, and also, I mean, Chicago is just enormous and sprawling and politically different than anything SCLC had ever taken on before. And really, about all they've gotten, this is how Jesse enters the picture, right? Like, well, we know this kid, who came to Selma for a day and a half, got himself introduced to King, and then went home. And indeed, they pick on him. They can see this guy has got the right stuff, that he's super self-confident, highly expressive. He doesn't have snick romanticism about the poor. He wants to be an activist Baptist preacher, just like they are. And so they can see a kind of younger version of themselves in him. And he's already in Chicago, so presumably he knows something about Chicago. This is where Jesse comes from, so far as the movement stuff goes. And he's always singular. I mean, he's the only thing that really came of that Chicago bloodbath that occurred was Jesse staying there, deciding he'd found a home, and working on Operation Breadbasket. So the early thing in his career is he going to go political, or is he going to kind of stick with to turn the breadbasket model into something? And of course, breadbasket is trying is striking against corporations who aren't employing African Americans, and pressuring them to make hires from top to bottom in ways that they just aren't doing. And he was remarkably successful at it. But yes, the relevant comparison to Young is that these are both figures for whom, now that the dreamer has been slain, Martin Luther King didn't really want his lieutenants going into politics, but it's a viable option. Now that you've already passed the civil rights bills, but they've killed Dr. King, and you're just in a whole other moment. Well, maybe the next phase of the civil rights movement should be people running for office, attaining real political power and getting as much as you can. So there are a number of people sort of take that route. And of course, Andy Young was the first one to do so. And then the next sort of most prominent figure to come out of this whole story to come out of the civil rights movement was Jesse Jackson himself. Not an insider. In fact, all the insiders from Atlanta, they don't like him. And they especially don't like him because of some things that happened. They didn't like him to begin with anyway, but then after the night that Dr. King was killed and some of the things that Jackson did that night, they just hated him. Then for some years afterward. In fact, it's only about right about the time you were turning into all this, Nathan, 1984, when he ran in 1984. Not until then did the Atlanta, group of veterans, of movement veterans, kind of made up with Jesse, because of course Jesse had now become this national figure running for president. That's who's just it's undeniable now that this is the figure who has taken the civil rights movement into a next generation and is doing something significant at a local level, to be sure, yes, in Chicago, but also at a national level. I mean, just no one, he's even gone past Andy Young by the mid 1980s as a galvanizing, to be sure, controversial, but enormously gifted and accomplished. And in some ways problematic figure.
Right. I've got a question just because I am an archivist at heart, and I'm always curious about these sorts of things. But Lewis A. Brandon said in a 1981 interview that all the copies of Jesse Jackson's 1963 letter from a Greensboro jail were destroyed. But you comment on the style and hint at the content of that letter in chapter three of this book. Did you see that letter before it was destroyed, or did you hear about it from someone who did?
Oh,
Because
goodness.
I
I
am
don't know
just.
anyone has actually had their have held it in their
Because
hands.
I know this is such a minor point in your book, but it grabbed my imagination and wouldn't turn loose.
Yeah, it is one sentence. But Samuel Proctor, this would when Proctor would start waxing on how Jesse is not quite like Dr. King, because of course Samuel Proctor loved Jesse, but of course his deep relationship and for many years prior was with Dr. King. I mean, those two went way back, and Dr. King was just his beloved to him. And he's the one who tried to talk Jesse into getting more of a seminary education in him, not just under him, but in him, and was always the one trying to sell him on the fact that, all that intellectualism in King, that's not just academic talk. That's doing real work for him, and you need as much of that as you can get. And this was always, part of his story when Proctor would start, waxing on this theme about how, Jesse never quite got there. And Jesse idealizes King, admires him to be sure, and yet never quite saw the necessity or quite did the work that would have lifted him to become someone who could have written a letter from Birmingham jail. That's all just in King's head, because he's just lived these arguments for years. And he is a true scholarly intellectual in a way that, Jesse never was. So this was always, Proctor's go-to story about, the difference, about how we know it illustrated it. That's all.
Very good, very good. Like I said, I'm sure if you found 100 people to read your book, 99 of them wouldn't be fascinated by that, but I'm the one. So listeners, I hope that you are hearing that this book is just a treasure trove of stories and examinations and things like that. We've only got an hour, so I'm going to move on to some of the academic theologians. And first, I mean, I want to talk a little bit about Samuel Proctor, who you just mentioned. Your chapter on Samuel Proctor's and James Cone's Black Liberation Theology starts with an observation that I want you to hear you expand on a bit, namely that, quote, Black Liberation Theology made a substantial headway in the academy long before it achieved much of a presence in congregations, end quote. Now, James Cone in God of the Oppressed at least implies that he's mainly drawing on sources that are already active in the Black church. But, you say that the academy goes first and then the church. Talk to our listeners a little bit about the ways that church and academy have related to each other when we talk about Black liberation theology specifically.
Yes, thanks. Well, there's a few things to be sorted out here. Firstly, of course, Proctor is
And by the
not
way,
a
I can't
liberationist.
call him Jim. You can call him Jim. I
Yeah.
can't. To me, he's always James Cone.
Oh, of course. Oh, yeah. Few things to sort out here. Firstly, Proctor was not a liberation theologian. Proctor is just a pure social gospel theologian. And so James Cone is the founder of Black liberation theology. He and Gustavo Gutierrez share this kind of founder status because Gustavo was making in a Latin American, in his case, Peruvian context, a remarkably similar argument that liberation theology begins with the questions of oppressed and dispossessed people, not the questions of or doubts of middle class disbelievers, as is the case with liberalism. So that's always the argument about how liberation theology is sort of simply starting in a different place. It's starting with oppressed people in dispossessed contexts. And now this plays out differently because certainly the issue of race plays out very differently between Cone and Gustavo, but they are very much alike in even the language of naming something as liberation theology. Neither one of them knew about each other when they they said certain things that were remarkably similar back in the late 60s and early 1970s. So that's the first thing. All right, secondly, yes, that you're quoting from God of the Oppressed there. Jim wrote that book in 1973 and 74. This will illustrate the point. It'll go to it quite dramatically. He's writing that book in those 2 years, and it's in many ways that is the insofar as his career as an academic theologian for another 40 years to come is concerned, that is the most important book he ever wrote, because he did get hammered, and in some of it in ways that hit him very, very hard, and he has to justify the kind of theology he's already put out there. Also make adjustments in it because some of this criticism hit him very hard and it got to him and he takes it seriously. But while he's writing this book that then did all these things, that is, that secured his career as a theologian, kept him here at Union, and went on to the whole career that he had. While that's all going on, James Cone is a member of the United Methodist Church. Which he calls the Antichrist, right? The white Methodist Church is the Antichrist. And yet he is a member of that church because he is not recognized as a theologian in the church in which he was raised, or in any of the black churches that he would prefer to join if he could. And if they're not going to recognize who he is. He's already got two books out there and got a third one actually by 1972, Spirituals and the Blues. So he had three books out there. And they don't invite him to conferences. They don't recognize him as anything. Just treating him as the other. That's his ecclesiastical situation when he wrote that book. Now, this is a happy story. It did turn out. Finally, the AME was glad to have him back. And he rejoined as soon as they were, certain amends were made. This is not Jim has a deep and powerful argument against the black churches of his time. And he's actually deeply alienated from virtually all of them at that time. What he has been pressed to make an argument that draws far more from black church history than he did in his early first couple of books. This is the part of your question you're hitting on something here. Is definitely the case. I mean, the criticism that he took seriously, as distinguished from the torrent of criticism that he did not take seriously, could have cared less about all those white liberals saying this isn't theology. That was just water off his back. But the criticism he got from Charles Long and Gayrod Wilmore and his own brother Cecil and Vincent Harding, he took very, very much to heart. And that criticism was, where's the Black church in this? Where's just even Black American history? It just feels like a reversal of what the theology you were taught in graduate school. And that hit him hard because they, in a way, yeah, it was true. And he had to find he had to excavate more the Black church sources and Black American cultural sources in James Cone, in himself, which means giving up some of that Karl Barth that was in the first couple of books, because of course Barth is all about how you can't take your stuff from culture; you gotta be it's all from above. Theology is the explication of the Word of God, and if you're not doing that, you're just baptizing some idol or another. He's got to give up some of that to write what became God of the Oppressed. And so he is, in that book, excavating far more from Black church tradition and Black cultural history than he had previously. It's the most important thing about that book, is the extent to which he does that. But it's, you know, it's selecting from this little stream and that one. It's David Walker and the abolitionist movement and Go Down Moses, and you know, it's pretty selective. And it's not much at all from most of these social gospelers that I'm writing about in these early volumes, because Jim didn't even know about those people, most of them. Because he was a product of his graduate school education. He knew what he learned growing up, and then he learned, you know, what he learned in graduate school, and all of a sudden he's writing books. So
I think that's most of us.
Yeah, he spent years just kind of, okay, what did I not learn yet? That is crucial for my own work, for my own thought. This is a subject of, you know, bitter regret to him, that he's got to excavate so much more from a Black history, Black church, Black culture experience. And yet he himself is not even in a Black church when he wrote these books. And of course, there are people calling him out for, you know, to them, this is just further evidence that he's simply made something up, right? That he's talking about something that isn't real actually in the churches. So, you know, that's where he was even in the early 1970s. For it to get deeper into the churches, it means that he has to teach, you know, a whole lot of students at places like at Union, and find a following out there that reads him and hears the gospel in a way they just never did before. And so, yes, this is an accumulative story where we're more and more we're getting people from seminaries like Union out into the churches, and now they're bringing liberation theology into the churches. But you know, we're still in a kind of a beginning phase of all of this, all through the 1970s. Just how it even played out. And there's no question it made its earliest inroads in the academy. Of course, bear in mind right there in the 1970s, the political context in terms of a great many Black churches is, these are churches who were against the civil rights movement back when it was happening, because only a minority of Black churches were ever in it. And we're ever really actively supporting it. But in that period after King is gone, we have far more now churches identifying with what King was about, what he struggled for, what he died for. And so, as you know from this book, this is one of my themes in the book, is that Black social gospel actually became a kind of new orthodoxy in Black churches in the years of the 70s. After King himself is gone. And meanwhile, you've got this challenge from, you could say, from the left, although left-right is problematic in this context, that is saying, no, social gospel is not nearly radical enough because it's not arguing from the standpoint of Blackness. And of course, that's what defines Black theology, is your Blackness is a lens, point of departure by which you are evaluating all the doctrines and just the very viability of Christianity itself.
Right. And another one of those streams that begins with story and begins with experience is the womanist movement. And one thing that I should have known before I read your book is the linguistic and etymological story of the term womanist. But just in case any of our listeners are in my boat, what discourse was Alice Walker invoking when she coined the term womanist? And what are some of her main contentions with Black theology and with academic feminist discourse?
Yes. Well, the term itself comes from a folk saying, "You acting womanish, you acting womanish." Walker is casting around the late 70s, early 80s for a term that's just fits better than Black feminist. Yeah, she's a Black feminist, and that's in a ballpark sense. There's a way that names it, but doesn't. There's just enough dissonance. She can't really identify with it. What would it be? Well, she's going to have to invoke a folk term and then invest it with a meaning that then sort of describes her own experience. And so womanism is this idea that she describes in the early 80s, and she says, in which she is describing the ethos of a Southern Black communal female culture. It's the folk wisdom, the moral wisdom of Black women, especially grandmothers. So many womanists of the first two generations. Not as many, not quite, this is not quite so much now in the third generation that we're in now, but certainly this first two generation. Most womanists that I know have got some kind of a grandmother story about attending to being in the presence of a grandmother who had looked at the world in a way that's deeply faithful and is not like church preaching. It's definitely nothing like white Christianity, and yet it's there's an ethos that's being described, including certain attributes, certain marks of wisdom, a kind of feisty unctuousness. That's one of Zora Neale Hurston's favorite words that the womanists sort of take over when they theologize this. I should say Alice Walker herself, of course, was not a theologian, not a Christian. Alice Walker is a spiritually humanist novelist. So this then becomes an issue in womanism, whether it ended up becoming too Christian, because the founder, the person who named it, actually wasn't Christian. But it is always sort of naming this very communal sensibility in which Black women love each other, love themselves. You have these grandmother figures who are kind of mama bears looking out for people in their environment, and so then explicating that sensibility, that ethos, that way of looking at the world as an alternative to Aristotle and Alasdair MacIntyre and Karl Marx and just all these other, you know, traditions of ways of this conceiving moral philosophy that are the inheritance if you're a Black woman of the 1980s entering the academy. And you're reading all this stuff, including Black liberation theology, that's just too male, too revolutionary, too androcentric to be something you could relate to. People like Kelly Douglas and Dolores Williams and Jackie Grant, you know, they read Alice Walker. Kelly Douglas told me the day I read that piece by Alice Walker, I leaped straight in the air and fell into a chair and said, yes, 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 this is it, right? There was a kind of sense of, I'm not even sure who I am here in the academy. I can't relate to what this place is, to what they're teaching us. I know I need to learn this stuff, and yet I don't know who I am in relating to it until, yeah, Walker helped to name something. By which the figures I just named read themselves into modern theology and ethics and created a discourse tradition within it, womanism, which is to be distinguished from Black feminism, because that's a thing too. But what people who are Black feminists who would say, I'm a Black feminist, not a womanist, would say is that, yeah, everything I just said is just too defined and too communal and too idiomatic. And so a person like a Black feminist like bell hooks, or Tracy West, would just say, you know, nobody tells me what to think. And often people who would say, I am in fact something more familiar to a white audience, that is a feminist, but a black feminist, would say, you know, there's a kind of moral, cultural policing, provincialism that's inherent in womanism that they would not identify with. So, you know, that's been an issue ever since.
Well, let's stick with bell hooks for a moment, because I mean, she is among the academic figures that you treat in this book. She's had more influence on me than others have, and I'm still trying to resolve this tension of her work. So I'd like to hear you comment on it. On one hand, she definitely criticizes the capitalist individualism that frames so much of academic feminism. But on the other hand, her public work deals fairly consistently with a spirituality of love that manifests in family and romantic attachment and other sites that folks often talk about as sort of islands or shelters against the storms of the political. So, I mean, how is it that she navigates that tension between fleeing the political, insisting on the political, or am I just reading her entirely wrong?
Oh, no. Firstly, Bell always had this just powerful personal voice. I brought her to Kalamazoo College in 1988, and she just gave an unforgettable, you were just held spellbound by the sheer force of her charism and just fully present, and in a way that's personally challenging to people. Somebody asked a cringy question about affirmative action that night, and oh my God, I just wanted to go underneath my chair at first. But she kind of took this person by the hand and walked him through a series of questions about, you know, well, I don't know, what kind of college, you know, do you want to be at a place where everyone sort of looks alike and comes from the same kind of place and read all the same books and so on? And was able to walk him to a point where he realized, oh yeah, actually I believe in this. And that was so her. Now she had from early on, yes, she has this critique of capitalism. I mean, just capitalism is kind of predatory and competitive and soulless and heartless, and it's just unless you have really strong government policies trying to break down what just capitalism just naturally does, it just naturally keeps replicating hierarchy. So you get, you know, richer getting richer and poorer getting poorer, and the people on the bottom just feeling more and more ground down, because, you know, that just has that dynamic. Yeah, it creates tremendous wealth explosions, but then wealth explosions that where the wealth mostly just goes way up to the top and everyone else just ends up feeling worse about themselves. She always had that critique. Although notice even the way I just put it, it's an emphasis on how the system impacts you personally, right? It's on your own character, your being. It's a kind of it's an assault, and that's of course how she always wrote. So for all of her anti-capitalist criticism, that's certainly there. You know, Bell never wrote about economic justice. She never wrote anything about, you know, theories of economics or, you know, decentralized forms of socialization or Keynesian economics. No, no, you don't get that. You never got that kind of discussion in her. That's why I've had to try to convince people, you know, actually it's there. I've known plenty of people who read Bell, they don't even see it. Because it's not, you know, it's not political economy, it's not programmatic in the way only on the only way that they recognize it. All right, so I am describing something that it is there for her. She would go to Socialist Scholars Conference and certainly identified with that. She and Cornell were very much alike so far as on this issue and really, frankly, most issues. She and Cornell West are very much alike. But I think this, it was always so personal for her. I mean, just trying to find her way, including her first book, Ain't I a Woman? She's just desperately trying to find literature about Black women, where it's like that womanist story I just told, for just trying to find your way in this context that's just so not you. It's got what she's studying and dealing with, it has nothing to do with where she came from or the life she had. And so trying to read herself into what is now going to be this academic career that she has to hammer her way to get. And then once she gets there, she's a fabulous teacher. I mean, just out of this world teacher. And also, not just because she's naturally gifted, she's also thinking about what's going on in the classroom. So many academics never even think about how they teach. Well, what's going on here? Right? It's just,
I can attest to that. Yeah.
Oh, my God. Here, and she, and that just appalled her. You know, how can you spend most of your life teaching? You never really even think about pedagogy. What's the point? No, her book, Teaching to Transgress, she's at least, you know, trying to get to all those academics who just don't even think about whether education is actually transformative or not, because she thinks it's pointless if it isn't. So I think that's always the key to her, that to who she is. That's in all these books. In her, just as she had personal struggles when she's just even trying to write her dissertation, had struggles with the academy when she was there, then couldn't find a publisher for a long time. It's only got published because South End Press, you know, came from nowhere and said and was willing to take it on. Then that book becomes an instant classic. So now she's somebody in the academy, but, you know, she was mostly embattled in the academy as well, just constantly being told by deans and colleagues, oh, you're not a real academic, and when are you going to write something scholarly, and all this kind of thing. And all the whole beating that she took over that, also just feeling ignored. I mean, as close as she was to Cornell, she always felt like, you know, he gets all this attention, and, you know, she's way down here.
Hey, he was in two Matrix movies.
Yeah. So there's also a story of disillusionment here with the academy. That's certainly much of her, what became her career. And then the last thing I'm going to say, I'm telling a story here about kind of an emerging person, you know, just finally claiming who she is, more so. But of course, the last piece of this is just her spirituality, because she had it long before it was in her books. In fact, she was embarrassed about it. She was embarrassed for people to know that, you know, she still went to church, and that she still, you know, thought about what she learned in Sunday school. And then, but then was also then on a spiritual journey. So then she's becoming some kind of a Buddhist, and that whole part of her, is just something that, it doesn't much show up in her books yet. And yet that is all that is occurring. So I think if you read all of her books, just sort of in sequence, just trace her career. This is someone who just more and more came to be herself. And so you can see who she was later on, writing these books about love and willing to be just incredibly vulnerable, so that when she shows up to an audience, she'll show up and there are 300 people there, and 200 of them know very intimate things about her. And so then she's willing to just, you know, tell jokes about it. And you know, they're there with her. I mean, they adore her. But she has a connection to a larger sort of trade audience that isn't the academy any longer. And she'll say, yeah, I found my group. If I just stayed in the academy, it wouldn't have happened. I had to really project far beyond just what was the academy to be able to find the, you know, oh, a whole auditorium full of people that I was really most comfortable with.
Well, let's talk for a moment about that relationship with the academy, because one of the central tensions in this book, as you tell the story of Black liberation theology, happens when the academy and the Black church accuse one another of limiting the potential for Black theology to affect its most important changes. So bringing it back to Georgia, talk a little bit about Raphael Warnock's rise to public power and how that dynamic between the academy and the church and the public sphere play out in his career.
Yes. Well, of course, Raphael grew up in the Cayton Projects in Savannah, the part of a very large family. Both of his parents are ministers. And so grew up poor and humble, and disciplined, and on the way, in a way, although you know, he ends up in a life he couldn't have possibly imagined when he was young. But always, he sort of took to being a preacher's kid, the kind of kid who's, you know, out giving sermons in the backyard when he's 5 years old, and sort of taking on the role, imagining himself as a minister, just like Martin Luther King did. Except Martin Luther King grew up middle class, you know, this is a you know, poor world Pentecostal background that he's in. To just even to get to Morehouse College is transformational for someone like him. But of course, he did get into Morehouse because he's very, very bright, and so gets there. And now, you know, that's in some ways that's the citadel of the Black social gospel, is Morehouse. I mean, that place has no history that isn't the history I'm telling in these three volumes. Morehouse is always there and is always that place where exactly what I'm talking about in these books is always being worked on. So he's very much sort of influenced by that, helps to send him on his way. So yeah, he gets to Union in 1991 because he comes here for seminary. And James Cone did always survey his classes in search of the next great Black theologian. You know, he founded Black theology, and he had a kind of guardian's relationship to it. He was a gatekeeper, and cared very much about the future of Black theology. So he looked for a particular type, someone who's very, very good at school, extremely smart, got lots of courage, is strongly self-identifies with their Blackness, is teachable, you know, and got some other it factor, right? And he picked Raphael out. In fact, this is after he'd had a number of doctoral students in the 80s that he put out there in the field. Raphael came along. Jim really put his money on Raphael. He thought that Raphael was going to be the one. And he was already a little worried, because when Raphael was here, he already started at Abyssinian, because, you know, in MDiv, students all have to do some kind of field work. So there he was at Abyssinian, and he's a hit. And Calvin Butts liked him, so it was giving him a lot to do. And he just sort of grew into a role at Abyssinian that was troubling for Jim, because Jim, you know, Jim is, it's one thing for a place like Union to train a lot of pastors for churches. Of course, that's our main business. And he has no problem with the 90%, whatever, that go there. But the people who are called to be theologians, to Jim, that is a special vocation, and that is not a sideline. And it's going to get sidelined if it ends up attracting people who are really just pastors and they do a little theology on the side, or they're really just using their PhD in order to be able to even get the biggest steeple church. You know, always, when I came here, and he would go on and on about how it just frustrated him, because there had been others, but Raphael was now example A of it, because, you know, I came here in 2005, and Raphael was now kind of 11 years into a doctoral program. I mean, he was already, you know, he was been to Douglas and then to Ebenezer after that. So he's well down the road of his pastoral career. Meanwhile, he still hasn't finished his dissertation, hung like a stone cloud over his head for years. And there are two basic things that Jim doesn't like about this. One, he's gone off into the ministry, and we've just sort of lost him. And he just feels like everything that Jim put into him, it just feels like it's going to be wasted in the pulpit, because we didn't need more ministers. We always have plenty of ministers. What we need are a few great Black theologians. Jim has no equivocation about that. So he does feel a certain betrayal over that, that Raphael has not showing proper gratitude for being able to almost to earn a PhD from Union. And secondly, even worse, the argument that he's making in his dissertation is Black theology is too much a creature of the academy, that in fact, it will never be what it needs to be. There's just a certain pretend quality to it, unless it far more deeply instantiates itself in the churches, in the really existing churches, such that it actually, the church becomes what Black theology, liberation theology says it should be. Well, it can only become such if it actually internalizes and preaches liberation theology in the pulpits. If we've got mostly, you know, conservative forms of evangelicalism in the Black churches and the liberation theology happening in places like Union, you know, which is pretty much a description of the status quo he felt while he was in seminary, doesn't cut it, doesn't change anything. So Raphael made a very strong programmatic argument about the academic captivity of liberation theology. Well, of course, Jim just hated that. Jim took criticism from Gayrod Wilmore, because Gayrod was his best friend. He took criticism from Gayrod Wilmore on this precise point that he would not take from Raphael. You know, well, Raphael's, you know, one of his own students. He's not going to take that from, you know. And so this was an issue of some tension between them. In fact, when Raphael went to Ebenezer, you know, it was a rather great achievement to end up.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's one of the famous historic pulpits.
Pulpit, yeah. You'd think he asked Jim to come preach his installation. Jim refused him. No, I'm not, you know, he's just not going to be mollified. No. Meanwhile, we got to get that dissertation done and out there. Raphael's book, The Divided Mind of the Black Church, is that the Black Church keeps passing on a divided mind from generation to generation because it's had four liberationist moments: slave religion, the invisible slave religion of the invisible church, the founding of the Black denominations, the civil rights movement, and then liberation theology. And yet all four of these things have been mediated by what he calls the evangelical hermeneutic. That because the Black churches are very much a product of the two awakenings, especially the Second Great Awakening.
Oh, sure,
it's deeply
sure.
Involved in the Second Great Awakening, since that revival ethos is just so much in the lifeblood of the Black churches. He says that it keeps mediating all the liberationist aspects of the Black church itself. And so the liberationist thrust that's in Black churches just keeps being arrested or truncated by what he calls this evangelical hermeneutic. Now, you know, Jim had no real problem with that. You know, that's a very credible argument. I think there are a couple things wrong. Well, there's one thing wrong with it. But it's in the, you know, in the main, this is one of the staple works now. It's a canonical text now. A landmark text in Black theology, The Divided Mind, and so perfectly captured in the title. What Jim didn't like, of course, is this academy business, as though there's something he should regret here, that liberation theology ended up succeeding in the academy. Last point about that, Nathan, it's also the case that the womanist movement has had the largest part of its success in the academy.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Churches,
yeah.
You know? And now we got another whole barrier because women, Black women, have fights that, you know, encounter resistance in Black churches to even be allowed to lead in Black churches. So there are plenty of Black women who end up in the academy because, you know, the church actually isn't open to them.
Right. There's no pulpits that'll have them.
So, yeah. Yeah.
Very few. I shouldn't make universal statements. Yeah. Well, Gary, here at the end of our hour, I'm going to go fishing because in the book's closing pages, you give readers what I hope is a preview of scholarship to come. When you note that scholarly work on Dr. King tends to focus on his organizing and his politics to the exclusion of his work as a philosopher. So what are some of Dr. King's most important philosophical convictions? And please tell our listeners that, if I'm just forgetting the book in which you address them, that there will be a new book by Gary Dorian on the philosophy of Dr. King.
Well, thanks, Nathan. It's a good place to end. Even worse than the way you led with that, I mean, even worse than what you described and the way you led with it, is are those historians who actually describe his religious philosophy in a way that's denigrating or patronizing or dismissive, as though they understand what they're talking about, because most historians don't. When you get into this area, they're just not trained philosophically. They couldn't give you one sentence on what is post-Kantian idealism. You know, Martin Luther King wrote a 450-page book on this, but you know, they don't know anything. And so somehow they're in a position to just dismiss it, as though that's just some kind of scholasticism, whatever it's about. And yet King and Howard Thurman both drank very deeply from this well of post-Kantian personal idealism. They knew the history of, they were trained in the history of philosophy. They interacted with it. They understood that every theology is only as strong as whatever philosophy it's sitting on. That there's some philosophy underneath any theology that you may have. So if you want a deeper theology, you don't know what you're talking about. Just have it be expansive, be powerful in ways that, you know, matter. You've got to become learned about this matter, which is not a universal sentiment within Protestantism. In the Catholic Church, it's just taken for granted, of course. And so in Eastern Orthodoxy as well. Protestantism, far more a mixed bag, whether we even get this. You know, hit and miss as to who gets the importance of philosophy. But King does. He got it at Crozier Seminary. He got it before that. Well, he got it at Morehouse, and got it at Crozier Seminary. And that's why he ended up at BU, because Boston University is the citadel of this school of philosophical idealism, personal idealism, of the post-Kantian sort. Now, there's a main distinction here. There's the Knudsen group. Knudsen was this great theologian at Boston University, who's basically a Kantian in the way that he understands, not in the philosophy that he develops. The more influential school at BU, though, however, in fact, most of the people who got their PhDs there and taught theology and philosophy out of BU, were Brightmanites. They studied under Edgar Sheffield Brightman. Here it's the difference between a more subjective, individualist kind of idealism, that's the Knudsen side, which is more Kantian, and the Hegelian side, in which now the argument is that, you know, we don't, our self isn't some I am I that kind of lights up from without, but rather we discover our selfhood in another. In fact, the Hegelian version of all this is, it's a type of objective idealism that's actually intersubjective in how and what it argues about the self in the world, how the self finds itself, any of it really. Justice itself is recognition of the other. King and Thurman are both much more on this Brightman side of it, but with a real appreciation of both. I mean, they're, you know, this is there are two sides to this school at Boston University, and they're both powerful, and they both, this is what matters about it, they both lift up the importance of personality as the be all and end all, that it's the philosophy that underwrites the conviction that every individual human being in the world bears a sacred dignity by virtue of being a child of God. Now you can say, well, that's just too Christian, because indeed that kind of language only came out of Christianity. It gives birth to other things later on, but that's very much a Christian worldview. The argument among those who found it and then kept sustained this school of personal idealism is yes, it's actually the best Christian philosophy, because it fastens on the most important thing like nothing else, that no other philosophy secures the sacred dignity and absolute rights of an individual like this personalist philosophy. So yes, King said that. He said you could not have said it plainer than he said it in his book Stride Toward Freedom. And Thurman said the same thing in his book The Creative Encounter. And I when I ended the book the way I did, little bit of yeah, there's a little bit of an edge there, but I am partly grinding my teeth at all those historians who just said, oh, there's nothing there. King was just an activist, and this philosophy stuff, whatever it is, it just gets in the way. No, you a better approach would be to take what King himself said seriously about what mattered to him. It was a joke out, out on the in the movement, that it wouldn't take much of anything. Suddenly he's going off on three forms of Greek love. I mean, he that seminary training that's in him, that is the ballast underneath him, it worked for him. He understood how it worked for him and was very eager to explain to people the why of it. And some people just think, well, philosophy is just too hard or too abstract or something. They can't imagine that it was as important to Martin Luther King as it was, but indeed it was. The
Very
place
good.
I've written most the most about that is in a book came out in 2020 called In a Post-Hegelian Spirit. There, I didn't go didn't wax quite as long on it in Breaking White Supremacy, but there's a fair amount of it there as well.
Very good. Well, Gary, I've been at the wheel for most of this conversation, so in the spirit of hospitality, I'm going to let you have the last word. What do you want our listeners thinking about Black liberation theology, political engagement, or whatever else as we head for the door?
I think thank you for that question, Nathan. Firstly, I will just say again, what I said at the outset, this trilogy, especially volume one, but then the whole trilogy to finish it, to be able to have now done the whole Black social gospel story, it is distinctly significant for me. I do take a certain satisfaction in it, like nothing else I have done. And one I waxed a little while ago about the narrow and the broad. It's one thing, but never just one thing. I think what I want to end with though is to say that I did drive to the end. While I'm taking into account, you can learn about all different manner of different things. There are all kinds of this and that and. That next to last chapter, oh goodness, it might make your head hurt just how deep in the weeds this discussion can get theologically. And yet, there is something quite simple at its core that defined it from the very beginning, that is a through line through this entire history. And I did keep it going by who I ended up with near the end. Of course, as you say, at the very end, I did this little philosophical thing in which King and Thurman are back at center because, yes, in a way, it all comes, to fruition. They are the synthetic figures. But the three I ended with before I get to that kind of philosophical coda at the end, of course, were William Barber and Stacy Blackman, Tr Tracy Blackman, and Raphael. And all three of them have this couldn't be more fundamental in a for all the complexity that's all otherwise there, a very kind of simple sort of argument about the gospel should take you into struggles for justice, that the church has a mission to transform structures of society in the direction of social justice, and that in fact we shouldn't really even need any of the rest of this ideological language that we have, parties, this side, that side. No, in fact, Tracy Blackman, she just refuses it. She won't even be called progressive. Don't put that on me. I'm just a gospel Christian. That's all, right? That should be enough. And Barber's pretty assiduous that way as well. It's obvious he's working on the Democratic Party side. I mean, you can't really deny it. But it's not like no, this is not some department of a party or of just even a political movement. We're involved in struggles for justice in political space. We've got to do that, and we need to drag the church into these struggles when necessary. But it's always on the basis of gospel values and gospel imperative and the gospel love ethic itself. That's what is motivating us, and that's what takes us into it. And I did end with three figures who, for whom it does cut to something that fundamental and that simple.
Gary Dorian, thank you for joining us on Christian Humanist Profiles.
Thank you, Nathan. So great to be with you again.
Listeners, thank you for downloading and listening in. The book is A Darkly Radiant Vision from Yale University Press. Christian Humanist Profiles is part of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our audio editor is Britt Stack, and I'm Nathan Gilmore saying, go in grace, go in peace, serve the Lord.